Medical Matters.
Joined now by Dr. Armin Gretschel, neurosurgeon at the Tygerberg Hospital and brain specialist, joining us now on the show. Dr. Armin, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Well, good evening. Thank you for the opportunity to come chat to everybody. I'm very glad to be here.
Much, much appreciated. Aneurysm. What is that?
Yes.
And why does it occur?
Aneurysms in the brain, and we're not talking about aneurysms in the body, so aneurysms in the brain are blister-like outpouchings of the big blood vessels inside the brain. And why do they occur? We don't really know. We know that around about 1 to 2% of the population, so 1 in 100 or maybe 1 in 50 of people have an aneurysm. And there are risk factors which make us more prone to develop aneurysms. These risk factors like high blood pressure, smoking, the female gender, certain genetic disorders, they put us at risk of developing these aneurysms. But why exactly they occur, we don't know. We are not born with them, so they develop over time. So exactly why they occur or what is the... There must be an inherent weakness of our blood vessel wall somewhere in the brain, which then put us at a risk of developing them. But what exactly causes this weakness, we don't know yet.
I thought you were going to say stress, Dr. Gretschel. I thought you were going to say, you know, when the stresses of life encumber us, and we find ourselves really, really in untenable situations, some sort of biological sort of chemical reaction takes place in our bodies, and no stress here? No stress as a factor?
No. It's funny that everybody says that when you're stressed up, I hope you don't pop your aneurysm. But no, stress plays no role there, not at all. I think the biggest risk factors that are smoking. I don't think anything good ever comes from smoking. Smoking and uncontrolled high blood pressure, but stress, definitely not.
And why would there be high blood pressure, uncontrolled high blood pressure? Why would that even occur?
So for us to develop an aneurysm, we must have a inherent weakness on a spot in one of our blood vessels in the brain.
Yeah.
And if we have, obviously, high pressures, that with every heartbeat, that blood, that pressure, that higher pressure against that weakened vessel wall will slowly cause it to form this blister-like outpouching, which ultimately the aneurysm is, and make it grow over time. And smoking, why smoking? Because smoking, one of the side effects of smoking is that it weakens our connective tissue all over in the body, and the same as the connective tissue in the blood vessel. So the tissue that makes our blood vessel, the walls of the blood vessel to keep its integrity, it weakens those proteins, which allows these blister-like outpouchings to form,
yeah,
and us develop aneurysms.
Only in the brain, Dr. Gretschel?
So I can't comment on the physiology about the or what causes aneurysms in the rest of the body. I mean that's outside my.
Do we get occurrences of aneurysms in other parts of the body?
Yes, definitely. Okay. We do get them, and smoking there also plays a role. So does hypertension, but the aneurysms in the rest of the body they have a different. There's a different pathology behind it on how they develop over time. There's a lot more atherosclerosis that plays a role there, which doesn't really play much of a role in the aneurysms in the brain.
Let's talk a little bit about smoking, because in all of the comments that you've made this evening, smoking has come up quite a lot. Let's just talk a little bit about smoking and what smoking is, right? And how, at least in the matter that pertains to aneurysms, it plays such a prominent role in the occurrence of aneurysms. Why smoking such a... I mean, I really want you to go down to the to the molecular sort of story without getting too academic on me, but why is smoking such a danger?
So with smoking, I obviously mean the consumption of the commercially available tobacco products. Besides the nicotine for which we smoke it for, and the nicotine is the stimulant which gives us the satisfaction of smoking and the joy of smoking. With smoking, with the inhalation of that, we inhale a lot of other toxins. And some of these toxins which ultimately cause a degradation and of certain proteins in the body, which is our connective tissue, our collagen. And by the degradation of these tissues, we lose or the body or these connective tissues hold certain cells together and give certain structures strength. And by the and smoking is toxic to these connective tissues, and they weaken and they break down and we can't really repair it effectively. And in the lung, when we lose these connective tissues, we cause lung damage, structural lung damage. We get emphysema, which is obviously a side effect of smoking. And in the brain, these connective tissues we literally find in the blood vessels, which give our blood vessels integrity. And as I said, if there are areas in these blood vessels that are already predisposed to a weakness, if we now weaken the structure of the blood vessel wall itself, it becomes even weaker and breaks down to the point where we can develop aneurysms. So, and these connective tissues that get, and as I said, I'm not a specialist in smoking, but these connective tissues from smoking can get affected all over the body and as well as in the brain.
Okay, so I get the smoking sort of factor, the variable, and why it has such an effect on those blood vessels that have a predisposition to that kind of weakness. What causes the predisposition?
So, in
other words, pre the smoking story, I would imagine what you're suggesting is that that particular vessel has a weakness there. There's a lack of cement somewhere there.
Yeah.
So what causes that?
That is what everybody still or science still needs to answer. So we're not born with aneurysms. Yeah. We develop them over time. So we develop them later in life. We develop them here in our 40s and our 50s. But we, from what we gather, is that certain areas or branching points of our brain vessels, there might be a weakness, but the propensity for that weakness to be developed, we are born with. But what really causes us to get weaknesses at certain spots, but not at other spots? Why we are born with them, but we're born with the weaknesses, but not with aneurysms that only develop over time? That is still unanswered, and that is still. A lot of research is happening in that, and find out is what is the genetics behind it, what is the epigenetics behind it, why is there a weakness, why are we born with weaknesses in certain areas but in other areas not, and when in the fetal development does that occur? That is not yet 100% answered, and there still needs to be a lot of research to be done to figure out why that happens.
You know, Dr. Gretchel, with my vast, very vast medical knowledge, I've come to know that acid plays a lot of plays some role in the weakness of certain tissue. In arthritis in the joints. Is acid, uric acid, for example, the issue with gout, and I'm hearing that a lot, inflammation in the body, could that be something that is a possible reason why certain areas can get weakened?
So acid, or uric acid, definitely not. But if we look at certain of the autoimmune diseases, so the diseases where we get uncontrolled inflammation in the body and our own immune system attacks our own body. Some of these autoimmune diseases can play a role in developing aneurysms, but that is extremely, extremely rare.
Yeah.
We extremely rarely see it. So I would say almost no. So our gout patients, our rheumatoid arthritis patients, they're at a higher risk of developing aneurysms than the rest of the general population.
Are you saying they're not at a higher risk?
No, they're not at a higher
okay.
risk, no.
Okay, okay. But as far as uric acid is concerned, I'm gathering.
Yeah, no, definitely not, no.
Yeah.
There's no relationship there.
Sorry, Doc, I'm sure you caught the very, very tight tongue in my cheek as I was saying my vast knowledge of of medical matters. It's just that I keep hearing acid and I hear cigarettes and I hear all of those kinds of things every time I hear about a seemingly unexplained occurrence physiologically that causes some sort of pathology. I keep hearing that kind of noise, and I was wondering whether or not acid in one way or one form plays some sort of role in the development of aneurysms. How does it present? How does an aneurysm present?
I don't want to frighten our listeners, but sort of if we look at the stats, around about 1 in 50 to 1 in 100 people have an aneurysm. The vast majority of these aneurysms are completely asymptomatic and will never cause any trouble.
Yeah.
So there is no reason to get concerned. There's no reason to go run to the doctor and say, please examine me and find out if I've got an aneurysm. So the most common presentation is with what we call a subarachnoid hemorrhage. When that aneurysm actually ruptures or bursts and causes a brain bleeding where there is a thin layer of blood that develops in the subarachnoid space, and the subarachnoid space is ultimately that area between the brain and the skull, and we get a bleed between the brain and the skull. And the way that presents to patients is that they get what we call a thunderclap headache, which patients describe as the worst headache of their life that had like an instant onset. So a classic description is a patient that comes to you and says, doctor, I've got the worst headache of my life. And it's like I've been hit with a cricket bat over my head. So the headache is at maximal intensity right from the outset, and it's the worst headache patients have ever experienced. So that history, simply when a patient tells you that story, the worst headache of my life, it's like the Americans say a baseball bat, the South Africans classically describe the cricket bat.
Yeah.
Without thinking anything further, that immediately must set off alarm bells and say, this could be an aneurysm. I need to look at this patient and find out if they had a rupture of an aneurysm. So the rupture is, and the subarachnoid hemorrhage is by far the most common presentation of an aneurysm.
What is happening there physiologically? Is it pressure being brought to bear on neurons? What's going on when that aneurysm bursts? Is it the heat from the what? Why the pain? Why is it so intense?
So ultimately, what happens is that little blister-like aneurysm just gives way and it bleeds, and there's a whole lot of physiology behind it. Catecholamines, a storm of adrenaline into the body, and there are lots of reasons why we could have the headache. Simply, the blood in that area causes us severe headaches. It could be that the pressure inside the skull goes up for a short period of time, and that pressure itself can cause a headache. We know that any sort of blood in the subarachnoid space, and ultimately the subarachnoid space is normally filled with the cerebrospinal fluid, the brain fluid, that any drop of blood in that space causes an inflammatory action with severe, severe headache. just like a meningitis would cause. But this headache is more severe. It's instant in onset, and it's a lot of factors together which cause this, that worst headache of that patients have ever experienced in their life.
What happens to that lining? The lining of that vessel, does it ever heal or? I'm talking about after it's ruptured.
Yeah, so it ruptures, and somehow there are a certain amount of people where that aneurysm and that rupture continues bleeding, and people die instantly. Okay, but those are small percentage of people. Those are 10-15% of people where it ruptures. In the vast majority of people, that rupture gets contained, and somehow the body manages to stop that bleeding. And there are lots of theories behind why that happens. But ultimately, the bleeding stops, and the blood flows normally through the vessels again, and we still have an aneurysm, which now has ruptured. And the problem is these aneurysms need to be treated. We need to somehow exclude them. We need to close them off, because if we don't close them off, they have got a very, very high risk of a second rupture within, they've got like a 50% chance of rupturing in the 2 weeks after the first rupture. And we know that a second rupture, so if they rupture again shortly after the first rupture, around about 80% of people will pass away from the second rupture. So these aneurysms don't heal themselves after the rupture. They need to be intervened on surgically, and they need to be closed off. And once they're closed, the vessel wall can heal itself over the area that we closed off, and then that aneurysm is cured.
You spoke about 10 to 15% being a small number. 10-15% of how many people? So in other words, I'm asking, what's the prevalence of the occurrences of aneurysms in our country, for example?
So if you take our whole population, we would say that one in every 100 people will have an aneurysm. But the chance of one having a subarachnoid hemorrhage, ultimately the chance of one of these aneurysms rupturing, is round about between 14 to 17 per 100,000 population. So if you think that of those 100,000 people, at least 1,000, which is, 1 in 100, should have an aneurysm, only around about 14 of those will experience a rupture.
Yeah.
A lot of them do well. As I said, a very few of these people that experience a rupture could potentially die instantly. And it's sometimes these are people who will just just drop dead, almost like a heart attack patient that just drops dead, and we're often difficult to figure out what happened. But we know sort of from history that if one of these ruptures, the chance of just dropping dead without ever having known that having an aneurysm is around about 10-15%.
Dr. Amin Gretschel is my guest. He's a real brain surgeon, folks, a real one. Hey? Give us a call, 011-883-0702. We're talking aneurysms. I've got a couple of messages coming through, Doc. Perhaps you might want to jot them down and perhaps handle them handle them together, but some calls coming through on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-056. So yeah, it feels a bit weird speaking to a brain surgeon. You know how everybody says, Dr. Gretschel, it's not rocket science or it's not brain surgeon. You know, the idea is that it's like really, really complicated stuff, right? So, you know, to talk to a brain surgeon is pretty something.
The brain surgeons say it's not rocket science, and the rocket scientists say, well, it's not brain surgery. So, it's a very common joke.
Touché. I get it. It's the jokes of the very bright, folks. The jokes of the very bright. All right, here we go. This person says, greetings, Aubrey. Hope you're well. Brain surgeon is correct. My late husband died of cerebral aneurysm. Yes, he was a smoker. He had high blood pressure and might have skipped a few of his blood pressure pills. It is true that smoking damages the cardiovascular system. Also correct that stress had nothing to do, as my late husband was no stressed at all. He was at the best of his game, says our listener here. This guy says, hey, dude, cigarettes helped me with my ADHD. We were talking about ADHD last week, doctor. So I suppose this person is protesting and saying, you know, you guys were talking about one thing last week and now you talk about another and you vilify the smokes. And then, of course, this one asks, Farai says, great medical topic yet again, guys. Thank you. My cousin died from an apparently sudden brain aneurysm a few years ago, and it really scared all of us. Can one foretell the onset of such conditions and prevent them? Does secondary smoke contribute to aneurysms too, Dr. Gretel?
Can I interrupt
you?
Sure,
go ahead.
So, it's always a very scary thing if a family member has an aneurysm. And a very common question is from the rest of the family, are we at risk? Do we need to get scans of the brain to see if we've got aneurysms as well? And so the answer here is no. Aneurysms, or if a family member has an aneurysm, as I said, it causes a lot of anxiety. But the vast, vast majority of aneurysms is what we call sporadic. So they're not; it's not an inherited disease. Mm. So the rest of the family, the children, brothers and sisters of our patient don't need to be worried. These are often single occurrences, except if two what we call first-degree relatives in a family suffer from aneurysmal ruptures or subarachnoid hemorrhage. So let's say two siblings or a parent and a child, if that should happen, then there could be this very small and rare occurrence of what we call inherited or familial aneurysm. And then we would advise that all the other siblings and all the other first-degree relatives need to be screened. So really, do we find younger people with aneurysms? And if we find them really young, so and with really young, I mean, you're sort of people in their 20s and 30s, if people there have aneurysms, it's just might be just prudent just to watch the rest of or other siblings as well. But often, if there are no other relatives in the family that have aneurysms, then there's no need for the family or siblings or relatives to be concerned that they might have one as well, because these are sporadic occurrences. Very, very rarely are these inherited, and that's why we do not screen families. We don't send them all for a brain scan to see if they've got aneurysms. And that's something maybe I should have mentioned earlier, but it's a traumatic event for the families, but the risk of the rest of the family having them is no higher than anyone else.
Let me take some calls. Mohammed is in Centurion in Pretoria. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, good evening, Doc. Good evening to you. Thank you for a good program.
Sure.
It's a quick question. My son, unfortunately, was involved in a serious MVA on the 3rd of Jan, was hospitalized in an ICU for 15 days, on a ventilator for 12. He's now in the rehab. With the grace of God, he's making a great recovery. Mm. They did about 3 brain scans, and, you know, And all 3 of them, even on the last one, they just said there's some spotting on the left-hand side of his brain, but very minor. And, you know, he's 21, it'll heal itself and so on and so forth. So, you know, he seems to be, you know, well in cognitive, et cetera, and functionalities. So 2 questions just quickly is that will it heal itself in terms of that? Because I heard you earlier on saying, you know, these things don't heal him. Though he had almost a 2-centimeter laceration on the head in terms of the vehicle accident. And the second question is, he's done 3 scans now already. Would you recommend, and when would you recommend for him to do another scan so we can kind of be 100% sure?
Thanks very much for that question, Mohammed. Please listen on the radio. Dr. Rachel?
All right. So the brain trauma doesn't cause aneurysm. So I can assure you there that unless there was penetrating injury, so that would be fine. the reason we often do re-scan patients following a trauma, that spotting that you might see most likely is, I mean, I haven't seen the scan, so I can't be for 100% sure, but what we call contusions are little bleeds inside the brain. And the reason we do re-scan is because these little bleeds inside the brain, they can cause a lot of swelling around them, and one wants to find out about the swelling quite early and keep an eye on it and make sure, because we can't look inside the brain unless we do a scan to see what happens to these little bleeds in the brain. Do they resolve? Are they swelling? Are they getting bigger? And sometimes it's not uncommon to do at least 2-3 CT scans to make sure that everything's settled. And most of the time, by the time people go to rehab and they're actually discharged from the acute care, from the acute neurosurgical ward, further scans will give us as no answer, unless there's a new problem that gets picked up, or a new concern that gets picked up by the doctor or by the rehab team, and one wants to figure out something doesn't quite make sense or something worries, and thus a new scan needs to be ordered to have a look what is going on inside the head. But as long as things are getting better and improving, a new CT scan or further CT scan is often not indicated, especially at this stage. I mean, we're talking around about 3 weeks down the line now. So unless conditions change for the worse, most probably not necessary. But that is obviously up to the treating doctors and treating neurosurgeons.
Yeah. Levi is in Orange Farm. Hi, Levi.
Hi, how are you, Aubrey? And hi, doctor.
Very good, thank you, Levi. Go ahead, sir. What is your question for the doctor?
Every second day, I get this terrible headache from on my left side. My left eye will be red and swollen, and it doesn't want to open properly. Then I feel like, I don't know whether to call them veins or nerves on my neck, being so painful, and they're like jumpy. And I feel like I want some fresh air. I feel like I'm struggling to breathe also.
Yeah.
So
your question is, could it be an aneurysm is your question?
Yes, yes. I want to find out if that could be related to that.
All right. Thank you very much, Levi. Doctor?
Okay, I can assure you that it's most probably not an aneurysm, because we don't get repeated headaches from aneurysms. So aneurysms don't really cause headaches unless they actually rupture and bleed, which causes the subarachnoid hemorrhage. But if you get so these repeated almost daily or once a week, twice a week headaches, which cause redness of the eye, severe one-sided headaches with pain mostly sitting behind the eye, causing redness of the eye. These are some of the headache syndromes, something like cluster headaches, which fall sort of towards the migraine type of headaches. They have nothing to do with aneurysms, but they should still be looked at, and I would seek medical advice for that. Somebody, not like a neurosurgeon, but a neurologist, somebody who deals with headache syndrome, to go have a look at that, because they can be treated and they can be treated quite successfully.
Yeah. Anonymous is in Pretoria. Good evening to you, Anonymous.
Good evening, bro. Doctor, sir, I just joined your show, so I'm not sure if the question was asked. I'd like to ask about if a baby was to be dropped, you know, and what possible effect that could have in later life, particularly cognitive and, you know, learning ability.
Because
when I was a child myself, I had a new sibling, and it's 20 years ago now, but I wonder if dropping him at that point may have affected his cognitive abilities, because he struggles with school. Let me just put it that way. He struggles with school. And there's a slight speech defect there as well.
Yeah. Doc?
That question is extremely difficult to answer. In a lot of these, I wouldn't say learning difficulties or children who have mild cognitive defects, we often look for, it's almost human nature to look for an event that might have precipitated that or caused that. Can trauma, significant trauma, cause it? Yes. Is it really the cause of the cognitive deficit that one finds many years later? It's impossible at this point to say, yes, it might be, it isn't. Repeated trauma, definitely sort of like a shaken baby or somebody who's got repeated head trauma, like our boxers, people who've got multiple concussions or people who've got one severe head injury, they can definitely have cognitive deficits and have neurological deficits following those traumatic events. But the causality is always difficult to establish if it cannot be established right at that point. Mm. So let's say you have a patient that's absolutely normal, is in a severe car accident, has got a significant head injury, and after that episode suddenly starts struggling with home, with schoolwork, university work, speech deficit. There we can establish causality. It's more difficult when you have younger children that might have had a single, let's say, head injury, which you don't quite know the severity of it. I don't know if the patient had a scan. And many years later, we find that children might have school difficulty. Once they go into school, 3, 4, 5 years later, struggling a bit at school, having some cognitive deficits. And one now thinks back, oh, could it have been that drop? Could have had been that trauma. So here causality is not established. So a question like that is difficult to answer and almost impossible to answer unless one has a point in time with a good baseline beforehand and can see that something has changed after an incident. If one doesn't have something that where one can pinpoint that point in time where things changed, it's almost impossible to say.
All right, let's talk about interventions, Dr. Yes. Gretchel. When I know that I have an aneurysm through whatever scans you in the medical world are able to find out, maybe let's ask that question first. Other than getting a severe, very severe headache,
okay.
What is the easiest way of knowing whether I have an aneurysm or not?
So, we don't look for them. So this is not like women where we go actively look, do they have early brain cancer or not? So there is no, all over the world, it's kind of, we do not screen for aneurysms. We don't actively go out and find patients with aneurysms because the risk of them actually rupturing or causing damage is quite low. And the risk-benefit ratios are not favorable of actively examining the population for aneurysms. But that's not to say that we don't find aneurysms in people that are asymptomatic. With medical therapies, most patients that go see their doctor and complain of lots of headaches or people who've had a minor bump on the head or minor head injury these days very quickly can get a scan of the brain. And aneurysms that people never knew they had, which are completely asymptomatic, are being picked up. So now here comes the problem, is the conundrum. Now I know I've got an aneurysm. So what next?
Yes.
So there are a lot of so treating these aneurysms, ultimately closing them off, has its own inherent risk. So here comes now the, I wouldn't say almost, I can't call it the crystal ball, but here comes the problem with managing these aneurysms, because now we need to weigh up the risk of leaving that aneurysm, the risk of this aneurysm ultimately rupturing, versus the risk of us going and medically treating it and closing it, surgically closing it off. So there are scoring systems that have been developed that look at the location of the aneurysms, on which blood vessel it is, what is the size of the aneurysm, is my patient hypertensive, does my patient smoke, which ethnicity that my patient has. And then we score these patients and we get sort of a rough idea of what the risk is of this aneurysm to rupture with time. And then we need to weigh up that risk versus the risk of us ultimately surgically treating it. And this becomes a discussion between neurosurgeon and patient, where we can present the risks of rupture and we can present the risks of our intervention. And then by discussion with our patients, we can make a choice of should we just watch this and follow it up with a news, with a scan in a year or two and see things change, or certain type A personalities can't handle the thought of having an aneurysm, they want them closed. And then it becomes sort of an informed consent or a very informed decision between both doctor, neurosurgeon and patient that then guides therapy. Once they have ruptured, though, and once the patient is presented with this worst headache of their life and these aneurysms have actually bled, they need to be treated. And the faster they're treated, the better, and we need to close them off surgically.
Anything we can do to prevent the occurrence of aneurysm, doc, besides not taking the Gunston toasted?
So, even if we have treated aneurysms, or if we know that patients have aneurysms, if they are smokers, we definitely ask them to stop smoking. Smoking not only increases the risk of developing them, but once patients have them, smoking also increases the risk of them actually rupturing and causing a brain bleed. Strict blood pressure control, definitely. If patients are hypertensive, strict blood pressure control can help. And then follow up. So repeating a brain scan around about 6 months, 1 year, look at what is the aneurysm doing. If it is growing, it's a concern, it definitely needs to be treated. If it remains unchanged, if it's a very small aneurysm in a very safe location, one can follow it up, repeating a scan yearly or every 2 years, and just watching it might be a very good strategy. Careful observation of managing that aneurysm.
Yeah. Any dietary sort of advice that you can give to try and mitigate against the possible occurrence again of aneurysm, Doc?
Not really. Obviously, to be quite, to almost sound like a broken record, because every doctor will give you that advice. A healthy diet, a healthy lifestyle, eating enough vegetables, not having too much cholesterol, having enough antioxidants, having enough fluids.
Okay.
Obviously, it's always healthy, but yeah. Will it really stop the occurrence of aneurysms? I can't answer that. But I mean, a healthy lifestyle is always something I think to strive for and something we should try to achieve, because a healthy population is puts less pressure on a healthier system.
Indeed. Dr. Amin Grechel, how do we get a hold of you? How do we get in touch with you and talk some more with you? Is there a Twitter handle? Do you have one of those?
Sorry, come again?
Do you have a social media platform where we can follow you, or any contact detail by which we can get in touch with you?
My email address is just gretchel@sun.ac.za. Okay. I'm a very, I would say I'm not very social media savvy, so I'm more avoided than anything else. But yeah, if one needs to get hold of me, I'm best to email, and Gretchel is gretchel@sun.ac.za, not co.za, but ac.za, which is my university email address. That is most probably the easiest way to contact me.
Dr. Armin Gretschel, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. A real-life brain surgeon, folks.